back the curtain on the early days of the fund's operations. The piece showed, with documentary proof, how Lowe had siphoned money from 1MDB via GoodStar, the first time anyone had detailed how Lowe took money from the fund in 2009. She embedded documents into her story to give it added heft. One email showed Sharol Halmy, the chief executive, pushing Deutsche Bank to send money to GoodStar. Another document named Seat Lee Lin as the investment officer for GoodStar, the shady Seychelles company, linking it to Lowe. And there were agreements for GoodStar to pay tens of millions of dollars to Tarek Obaid. Rue Castle Brown had hit the motherlode. And days later, The Edge would follow up with its own investigative scoop. The news of Lowe's apparent theft caused a civil war within UMNO. A faction led by Mahathir called openly for Najib to resign. Some senior politicians even arranged to tap the Prime Minister's phone and heard him discussing with Joe Lowe a plan to put the blame for any corruption on 1MDB's Middle Eastern partners. Until the dust settled, Najib ordered Lowe to leave the country and keep a low profile. In public, the Prime Minister denied any wrongdoing at 1MDB, but nevertheless ordered an official government investigation of the fund, led by the National Audit Department, a body tasked with checking state finances. The Public Accounts Committee of Parliament, headed by an UMNO politician, began to clamor for answers. The committee ordered Lowe to appear before it, but no one knew his location. For years, Lowe must have been expecting this day to come. How could he believe it possible to take so much money, revealing parts of the scheme to a prime minister, a Saudi prince, Malaysian bankers, and the head of an Abu Dhabi sovereign wealth fund, while keeping the full contours of its audacity to himself? In the days after the Sarawak report scoop, Lowe acted as if he'd steeled himself for this situation all along. Many people, caught in the act of something much less felonious, would crumble and admit all. Najib was even talking to family members about stepping down. But Lowe was ready to fight. It was a survival instinct, for sure, but perhaps after years of fabrication, he found it hard to perceive the hard line that divided truth from falsehood. Maybe he really did believe he was benefiting Malaysia, building ties with foreign governments and raising the nation's profile. As the news broke, the Malaysian was traveling the world on his jet, and he sent off a barrage of messages to his associates. He told Khaldun Al-Mubarak, the chief executive of Mubadala, that Malaysia's government had found no evidence of wrongdoing. The reports were based on fabricated emails from PetroSaudi. "We expected these few months to be filled with noise, innuendo, and misinformation from certain political quarters," Lowe wrote Al-Mubarak. He blind-copied Ambassador Oteiba, showing his ally how he was trying to keep the situation under control. "Please note, the Sarawak report exposé is sensationalized, filled with innuendo and baseless accusations," he messaged Joanna Yu at AmBank. Yu did not respond. She was too busy closing Najib's accounts. Finally, under pressure from AmBank's board and amid a constant shortage of funds, the Prime Minister had to acquiesce. For Yu, the scope of what she was involved in was revealing itself. Of course, she knew it was illegal to keep an account secret, even one controlled by the Prime Minister, and to hoodwink the central bank and the board. But the scale of Lowe's scheme was probably far from her imagination. A few days after Lowe's last messages to Yu, Malaysian police raided AmBank. They moved through the bank's headquarters, a skyscraper close to the Petronas Towers in Kuala Lumpur, asking to be directed to Yu's desk, where they demanded she hand over her computer and phones. She complied immediately. There were no other senior executives left at the bank for the police to question. Her former boss, Chia Tek Kwong, had gone into retirement months earlier. Ashok Ramamurthy had resigned as AmBank's chief executive in a hurry in early March to return to a job with ANZ in Australia. And soon after, he would leave the bank entirely. In the wake of the Sarawak report story, Malaysian law enforcement agencies felt emboldened to take action. setting up a task force to investigate the 1MDB affair. The group included Bank Negara, the National Police, the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission, and the Attorney General, the country's top public prosecutor. The evidence taken by police about Najib's accounts, including Yu's phone messages with Lo, painted an extraordinary picture. In the ensuing weeks, officials at Bank Negara Malaysia, under Governor Zeti Akhtar Aziz, combed through the documents from the raid, revealing a stunning fact. The Prime Minister had received more than $1 billion into his personal accounts between 2011 and 2014. The biggest payments, totaling $681 million, were from an unknown company called Tanor, which had an account at Falcon Bank in Singapore. Given the explosive nature of its discovery, the task force decided not to reveal the information to the public for now. The Sarawak Report story made no mention of Najib's accounts, and as yet, the central bank had no evidence the Prime Minister had received money from the 1MDB fund. But it began to cast its investigatory net in a wider arc. Bank Negara reached out to Singapore's police for information on Joe Lo's accounts. The Suspicious Transaction Reporting Office wrote back on March 13th that a company account at BSI in Singapore, owned by Lo, had received $500 million between 2011 and 2013 from Goodstar. This was the company Sarawak Report had mentioned, and it appeared to reveal another step in the money flows. But it didn't connect 1MDB to the Prime Minister. Still, the probe had momentum, and Singapore, normally keen not to upset the equipoise of its lucrative private banking world, began to dig in. If proceeds of crime have been transferred to Singapore, we would like to consider whether an offense has been committed, Chua Jia Leng, head of the Suspicious Reporting Office, wrote Bank Negara. Authorities in Malaysia and overseas were closing in. As Lo and Najib were trying to contain the fallout, another major figure was in peril. Kadem Al-Kubaisi of IPIC. Chapter 43. Buttocks in a G-String. Tel Aviv, Israel, April 2015. Behind an office building in Tel Aviv, the flames of an impromptu bonfire melted the plastic of several USB sticks. Two men stood watching over the fire. One, Mohammed Al-Husseini, the chief executive of the Abu Dhabi fund ABAR, was there to ensure its contents were incinerated. Al-Husseini, who had helped Lo take money from the 1MDB bonds arranged by Goldman, watched as singed bits of paper from a stack of burning documents floated into the sky. They included secret files and photos that risked bringing the career of his boss, Kadem Al-Kubaisi, crashing down. The documents had been removed from Al-Kubaisi's home and office in France by Rassem Ho, a French-Algerian man. Over years of corrupt deals, Al-Kubaisi had made a raft of enemies, and Ho was among them. For years, Ho acted as a glorified butler for Al-Kubaisi, arranging cars, jets, and reservations, while also occasionally passing messages between his boss and people making discreet payments. Ho was handsomely remunerated, but he must have become increasingly envious as he saw Al-Kubaisi and subordinates like Al-Husseini line their pockets with hundreds of millions of dollars in kickbacks. In a magnanimous moment, Al-Kubaisi said he would throw him a morsel, a stake in a big real estate play in Spain. But he later reneged on the deal. Soon after, in early 2015, Al-Kubaisi fired him. But Ho already had an insurance policy. Over time, he had amassed a raft of compromising information on his former boss. The documents included Al-Kubaisi's bank statements, details of his multiple French properties, and payments on Sheikh Mansour's yacht, Topaz. Ho leaked a selection of the documents to Claire Rucastle Brown, who published a story in late March 2015, just weeks after her exposé on Joe Lo. The piece outlined how a Luxembourg company owned by Al-Kubaisi had received $20 million from Goodstar, Lo's shell firm, in February 2013. It was accompanied by photos, also supplied by Ho, of the IPIC managing director partying around the world. In one shot, he was dancing in a club while a topless model cavorted in an oversized cocktail glass. In another, he was making out with a woman on a sofa, behind some shisha pipes. Yet more photos showed him in clubs wearing t-shirts with lewd images, including one that featured a close-up of female buttocks wearing a g-string. It was common for wealthy Gulf residents to shed modest Arab dress in the West, but these bawdy party photos were beyond the pale, especially after they were publicly disclosed. Ho had only given a drip of his total information to Rue Castle Brown. According to a later complaint, filed and then withdrawn, Ho, through an intermediary, set about trying to extract money from Al-Kubaisi, warning that, if he did not pay, more material would come out. The material, touching on Sheikh Mansour's business, was extremely sensitive. Acting for his boss, Al-Husseini helped arrange a transfer of 30 million euros to Ho in return for the destruction of the documents. After the payment was made, Al-Husseini traveled to Tel Aviv, where he and an intermediary for Ho built their bonfire. Al-Kubaisi hoped further trouble had been averted. With the continued backing of Sheikh Mansour, he might have believed himself to be untouchable and more dominant than ever. Within the past year, Al-Kubaisi had put his $500 million in 1MDB money to work, purchasing a penthouse in New York's Walker Tower for $51 million and two mansions in Los Angeles for a combined $46 million. As chairman of Hakkasan Group, a nightclub empire owned by Sheikh Mansour, he had become one of Las Vegas's most powerful businessmen. Around the time of Ho's blackmail threat, Al-Kubaisi launched the Omnia nightclub in Caesar's Palace. Its name meaning the sum of all things in Latin, Omnia was the most expensive nightclub ever built, at over $100 million, and could host more than 3,500 revelers. Al-Kubaisi's domain featured a 22,000-pound light-emitting kinetic chandelier, hovering like a UFO over the main dance floor, along with state-of-the-art liquid crystal displays, opera boxes that looked down on the main club, and an outdoor terrace with views of the strip. The opening night in March 2015 featured superstar DJ Calvin Harris, who was paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a night to perform. And Justin Bieber celebrated his 21st birthday at the club over the star-studded weekend of festivities. But Al-Kubaisi's optimism was misplaced. Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, the ruler of Abu Dhabi, had decided to take action. The dealings of his brother Sheikh Mansour, overseen by Al-Kubaisi, had gone too far. The Crown Prince ordered a discreet investigation into Al-Kubaisi. With his brother completely in the dark, investigators piled up evidence of financial wrongdoing, painting a picture of Al-Kubaisi as a man who had grown too powerful, failing to respect the royals for whom he worked. On April 22, 2015, a presidential decree ousted Al-Kubaisi from IPIC, without explanation. A few months later, his subordinate, Al-Husseini, was kicked out of Abar, the IPIC subsidiary. Al-Kubaisi was in Spain at the time for business, and initially brushed off the change as a temporary issue, and attended a football game between Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid in the evening. He didn't realize the seriousness of his predicament. Sheikh Mohammed was cleaning house. In the Gulf, the ruling families were protected, but Al-Kubaisi was in danger. For Lo, Al-Kubaisi's downfall removed one of his closest conspirators. It was unclear how deeply Abu Dhabi's rulers would probe. Surely they didn't want to embarrass Sheikh Mansour. But Lo recognized the ouster was dangerous for him, and he took immediate action. Less than a week after the axe had fallen on Al-Kubaisi, Lo flew by private jet to Abu Dhabi on a damage control exercise. With Al-Kubaisi out of the picture, Lo was laying the groundwork to put the blame on his former partner. If the full story about the money stolen via IPIC ever came out, Al-Kubaisi, already a fallen man, could take the responsibility. Lowe had ensured his name wasn't attached to documents, but the signatures of al-Husseini and al-Kubaisi were all over the place. "There's rumors going round that I'm a buddy of al-Kubaisi, and money has gone missing, but it's an internal IPIC issue if some of the money 1MDB sent is not showing up in IPIC's accounts," Lowe told Shaher Awatani, Ambassador Oteba's business partner, in one meeting. In another meeting with the new head of IPIC, Suhail Al-Mazrui, Abu Dhabi's energy minister, Lowe portrayed himself as a savior who could chart a course out of the wreckage left by al-Kubaisi. By now, IPIC's new management had gone through the financial statements and were beginning to see that billions of dollars it should have received as collateral for guaranteeing 1MDB's bonds were missing. Alarmingly, the Abu Dhabi Fund was on the hook for $3.5 billion in bonds that 1MDB had sold and didn't seem able to repay. The Malaysian Fund was on the brink of default. Deutsche Bank, finally aware of the problems with the Cayman Islands collateral, was demanding early repayment of its total $1 billion in loans. Lowe offered a solution. IPIC would stump up the $1 billion to avoid a default. And in return, Malaysia's finance ministry, which Najib also headed, would agree to ensure IPIC was fully repaid in cash and assets. It was unclear how the fund would raise such money. The IPO was on hold amid all the bad news. But IPIC's new chief had little option but to accept. Al-Kubaisi appeared to have been involved, and he was keen to keep a lid on the scandal. After speaking with Najib, Minister Al-Mazrui agreed to the arrangement, and both sides soon after signed a formal deal. Lowe had other problems bubbling that he needed to sort out in Abu Dhabi. Ambassador Oteba was concerned about queries he had received from BSI. As Singapore authorities ramped up their probe, BSI had been forced to make a show of auditing all accounts related to 1MDB and Joe Lowe. The bank was in chaos. Hans-Peter Brunner, the head of BSI in Asia, put Yok Yu Chi, Lowe's relationship manager, on unpaid leave in the spring. In return for his bonus, the bank's head of compliance in Lugano attempted to wring a signed declaration out of Yok that he had received no gratification in dealing with 1MDB and Lowe. Unwilling to be singled out as a scapegoat, Yok took off to rural China to bide his time, and quickly fell into a depression brought on by stress. The bank's compliance department had begun to investigate all Lowe-related business, and that had led them to contact Oteba and Awatani, whose shell company, Densmore, had an account at BSI. "You should close your accounts. The bank is too much in the limelight. I've moved out most of my major assets and will close the remaining accounts soon," Lowe advised Awatani in their meeting. Then he set about enlisting his help. Lowe told Awatani he wanted to buy his own bank as a parking spot for his money, and that of friends and family, and had just the candidate, an Amicorp bank affiliate in Barbados. Lowe had used Amicorp for many transactions, and its bank was on the auction block for $15 million. But Lowe needed a front, and he wanted to know if Equalis Capital, a Dubai-based financial firm controlled by Oteba and Awatani, would be willing to acquire the bank. Already alarmed by the events of the past few months, Awatani was non-committal. Instead, Lowe shifted some of his accounts to Amicorp's bank. He also looked for other new places to stash his money. For help, he once again turned to Tim Leisner. The German Goldman banker was willing to help, writing a letter of reference in June 2015 to Bank Haviland, a small but illustrious Luxembourg private bank. At this stage, few banks would touch Lowe, but Leisner's letter, falsely stating that Goldman had conducted due diligence on Lowe's family wealth, opened doors. It was a decision that would seal the banker's fate. Lowe was taking actions to shut down scrutiny of 1MDB and to hide his own assets. But this piecemeal approach wouldn't do. It was too reactive. He needed to make a more aggressive move, to fire a warning shot across the bows of anyone thinking of crossing him. Chapter 44. Strongman Najib. Koh Samui, Thailand, June 2015. On a hazy, hot, tropical afternoon in late June, Xavier Justo was relaxing at his villa on the island of Koh Samui. Suddenly, armed Thai police burst in and muscled him to the floor. Once officers had secured the suspect, tying his hands so tightly with plastic cuffs that his wrists bled, they ransacked his office, carting off computers and other documents. He was flown to Bangkok, where a convoy of police SUVs drove him across the city to a holding cell. 2 days later, still wearing his beach outfit, a gray Hugo Boss t-shirt, cream shorts, and flip-flops, Justo was paraded in front of the media in Bangkok. As the Royal Thai Police Chief reviewed details of the case, five commandos in dark shades and brandishing machine guns stood ominously over Justo, whose hands were still cuffed. On a table nearby stood the computers taken from his residence. This was the kind of dramatic staging Thai authorities reserved for drug kingpins, not someone charged with attempted blackmail and extortion. Awaiting trial, Justo was placed in a Bangkok jail with 50 other prisoners. The stench of urine and the lack of floor space, or even a mattress, made it impossible for him to sleep. He was relieved when a former British police detective, Paul Finnegan, who ran his own consultancy, turned up to visit. Finnegan was working with Petro Saudi, but he told Justo he was a police officer investigating the case. Finnegan offered Justo a deal. Plead guilty to the charges, and he would get out of jail before Christmas. Tariq Obaid would help him, Finnegan promised, but only if Justo was cooperative. A few days later, Mahoney arrived at the jail cell and made similar promises, according to a complaint Justo later filed. Stressed from the ordeal, and yet to have been given legal representation, Justo signed a 22-page confession, in which he apologized to Petro Saudi for stealing the documents and negotiating to sell them to the Edge. This was phase one of a plan to discredit Justo, cast doubt on the authenticity of the emails, and blame Malaysia's political opposition for stirring up trouble for the prime minister. His resolve galvanized by Rosma, who called the situation a test from Allah. Najib was not going to resign so easily. We have been the victims of a regrettable crime that has unfortunately been politicized in Malaysia, Petro Saudi said in a statement. The day after the arrest, the New Straits Times, an English-language newspaper owned by the ruling UMNO party, published a piece quoting an unnamed spokesman from Protection Group International, a London-based cybersecurity and corporate intelligence firm, as saying it had reviewed the leaked emails and found evidence of tampering. The firm, owned by a former British Royal Marine, had been hired by Petro Saudi, but it had conducted only a review of a few documents available on the Sarawak Report website. Now, its private review for Petro Saudi was being plastered over UMNO's party mouthpiece. Only Najib, or other senior UMNO politicians, could dictate to the New Straits Times what to write. After its publication, Lowe quickly forwarded the story to Khaldun al-Mubarak of Mubadala, the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund, to mislead his allies in the Gulf into believing that the Petro Saudi emails were somehow fake. A month later, Justo was still languishing in jail, awaiting his trial, when a Singapore journalist turned up for an interview. The reporter had provided the questions ahead of time, and Finnegan supplied Justo with prearranged answers. Justo told the journalist how the Edge had failed to stick to its promises to pay him, and now he made a new claim. During the meeting in Singapore with Rucastle Brown and the principals at the Edge newspaper, the buyers had talked about how they planned to modify the documents he provided. Justo repeated the claims in another meeting with Malaysian police officers, his answers scripted by Mahoney and Finnegan. Justo had to help Malaysia's prime minister by blaming Rucastle Brown. And at all costs, he was to avoid mentioning Joe Low, they told him. Since the publication of the Edge's stories, Ho K. Tat and four other staffers had been detained by Malaysia's police under the Sedition Act, and then let go, in what appeared to be a clear act of intimidation. Najib's administration also recently had brought in a new law, on the surface aimed at curbing terrorism, but permitting suspects to be held indefinitely. No evidence emerged supporting the claims of tampering. Justo was under huge pressure from Mahoney and others to back their version of events. Ho responded with a note on the Edge's front page, denying the newspaper had paid anyone or tampered with the documents. The publication, he wrote, had a public duty to find and report the truth. So far, Prime Minister Najib had stayed out of the fray, but that was about to change. The Malaysian Government Task Force, led by Bank Negara and the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission, had pored through thousands of financial transactions in the Prime Minister's accounts. The biggest incoming payments, $681 million from Tenor, were still a mystery, and the investigators were no closer to knowing who controlled the company or why it had paid money to Najib. Even governments could not easily see behind the veil of offshore secrecy. And Trident Trust, which had set up Tenor in the British Virgin Islands, only knew that Eric Tan was the ultimate beneficial owner, not Joe Low. But investigators had been able to trace a much smaller amount of $14 million from 1MDB to one of the Prime Minister's accounts. The Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission, whose job was to build major cases for the Attorney General to prosecute, believed this smaller payment was sufficient grounds for criminal charges. But there was a hurdle. Some members of the task force, especially the National Police, were objecting to moving ahead to frame charges against a sitting prime minister. The only option was to leak the documents detailing Najib's financial transactions. Just as the task force was looking for a candidate, we published a front-page story in the Wall Street Journal, the most detailed piece yet on how Najib had used 1MDB as a slush fund. The story caught the eye of an intermediary for the task force. A few days later, a Malaysian source met in London with Simon Clark, a journal reporter, to confirm the veracity of the documents, which the intermediary handed over hours later. Sarawak Report also received them. The files, copies of wire transfer documents into Najib's accounts, as well as money flow diagrams produced by the task force, were explosive. Under the headline, "Investigators Believe Money Flowed to Malaysian Leader Najib's Accounts Amid 1MDB Probe," the journal reported on July 2nd how the task force had traced the money into Najib's accounts via 1MDB-linked entities. After months of conjecture about the Prime Minister's involvement and his fervent denials of wrongdoing, the story was a tipping point, splaying the issue across the pages of one of the world's most well-known newspapers. The journal story was among the most read online items of the year, garnering more than 250,000 unique visitors online. Now, the 1MDB story had a global audience. A few days later, we reported how Singapore was investigating payments made to Joe Low. The Edge could have its publication license revoked, but now Najib was faced with The Journal, an organization that didn't rely on his goodwill to remain in operation. With few other options, the Prime Minister came out swinging, realizing this was a fight for political survival. Within a week, The Journal received a letter from Najib's lawyers asking for the newspaper to clarify its position on the story, or possibly face a lawsuit. The Journal's lawyers responded that the paper was standing behind its piece. Najib also took to Facebook to paint the allegations as the work of Mahathir Mohamad, the former leader, who had intensified his calls for the Prime Minister to step down over 1MDB. "Let me be very clear. I have never taken funds for personal gain as alleged by my political opponents," he said in a Facebook post. "It is now clear that false allegations such as these are part of a concerted campaign of political sabotage to topple a democratically elected prime minister. The journal story galvanized the Malaysian task force into action. Members of the group shared further password-protected documents on their investigation with the journal. The password for many of the files? Save Malaysia. On July 24th, Attorney General Abdul Ghani Patel informed Malaysia's police chief that he was drawing up criminal charges against the prime minister. He was preparing to take the document, known in Malaysia as a charge sheet, to a judge, the first step in seeking the prime minister's arrest. The document, laying out charges against Najib, noted how the payments were illegal under Section 17A of the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission Act of 2009, a provision prescribing the giving or receiving of bribes, and that carried a maximum jail term of 20 years. Najib's room to maneuver was narrowing fast. Even Deputy Prime Minister Muhyiddin Yassin began to make speeches quoting from the Wall Street Journal and demanding a transparent investigation on 1MDB. But the police chief, supposedly part of the task force, decided to switch sides at the last moment and informed Najib of his impending arrest. Overseas, the prime minister was considered charming and a Democrat. Only months earlier, he had given a speech at Malvern, his old boarding school in England, in which he thanked his teachers for instilling in him decency, discipline, and perseverance. A politician needs at least two of these, he quipped to laughter. No one perceived Najib as either decisive or ruthless. But now, fearing he could end up in jail, a steelier edge to his character came into focus. At this crisis point, raw power was all that mattered. On July 27, 2015, 3 days after Najib got wind of the charges against him, he breezed into the ballroom of Kuala Lumpur's Hilton Hotel for a dinner to celebrate Eid al-Fitr, Islam's holiest festival. Thousands of people, the great and good of Malaysian society, had assembled for the event, and the conversation revolved around the country's mounting political crisis. Most of the guests expected that Najib would soon be political history. Dressed in a Malay-style purple silk shirt, the prime minister took his place at a table reserved for VIPs, shaking hands with many of the UMNO politicians who wanted him gone. Only the prime minister knew the fury he was about to unleash on those disloyal to him. The morning after the dinner at the Hilton, Attorney General Abdul Ghani Patel arrived at his office to find the way barred by staff and security from the prime minister's office. Abdul Ghani no longer had a job and could not even enter the office to collect documents, they informed him. An hour later, Najib replaced the head of the police special branch, who had been instrumental in the probe into the prime minister's accounts. Later in the day, a fire broke out in police headquarters, destroying scores of documents. Najib fired Deputy Prime Minister Muhyiddin and four other cabinet members, and he suspended the Public Accounts Committee's probe into 1MDB. The prime minister sought to cow other critics, including the media. The Home Ministry suspended the Edge's publication licenses for 3 months, claiming its reporting on 1MDB could lead to public disorder. In one brutal house clearing, Najib had solidified his control on power. Days later, British Prime Minister David Cameron flew into Malaysia for an official visit. He'd just given a speech in Singapore about how Britain needed to stop corrupt cash from flowing into London's property market, where Malaysians were among the biggest buyers. In private, he pressed Najib on the corruption claims and Malaysia's human rights record. Najib was furious at the lecture by Cameron. His love affair with Western democracies was over. As Najib battled to stay in power, Joe Lowe was forced to cancel his participation in a National Geographic expedition, which would include Leonardo DiCaprio, who was filming Before the Flood, his documentary about global warming. The journal published its stories about Najib's accounts and Singapore's investigation of Lowe just as he was about to set off. As he dealt with the fallout, Lowe sent his parents in his stead, DiCaprio, a Victoria's Secret model who accompanied the actor, Lowe's parents, and a group of National Geographic scientists spent 3 days flying helicopters over the receding ice sheet in Greenland and filming polar bears. Afterward, DiCaprio announced his foundation was donating $15 million to environmental organizations, including National Geographic, which Lowe also had funded. By August, with the Prime Minister's crackdown in full swing, Lowe felt reassured enough to fly by private jet and helicopter to join the Equanimity in the seas off Greenland. For over a week, he went completely dark, visiting the National Geographic scientific camp and stunning people who were seeking regular updates on developments. "He literally traveled to the end of the Earth and went completely offline," said a Middle Eastern contact. Perhaps Lowe was feeling confident the worst was over. Maybe he wanted to make a show of business as usual, clinging to his image as a philanthropist. On his return, he nonchalantly wrote another contact, "I apologize for my late response, as I have been on a conservation expedition in the Arctic with limited coverage." Or maybe the trip was like a gambling session, a short break from people calling and demanding answers. He exhibited few other signs of confidence, and he seemed increasingly agitated that Najib would burn him. Over the summer, he told a 1MDB board member, "If they sacrifice me, I'll go nuclear. I was acting on the instructions of the boss." The Prime Minister had warned Lowe to stay out of the country as the crisis deepened, and he began to lay low in Bangkok, the capital of Thailand, and Shanghai, China's financial capital, where he stayed in the residences of the Peninsula Hotel. Unbeknownst to all but his closest contacts, he had also obtained a new passport from the tiny island nation of St. Kitts and Nevis. In August, Switzerland's Attorney General announced he had launched a criminal investigation of 1MDB and frozen multiple accounts containing tens of millions of dollars. With many of his accounts in Singapore and Switzerland now shut, Lowe was being shunted to the furthest reaches of the global financial system, forced to rely more on Thai baht or Chinese yuan transactions. The bonds between Lowe and Najib remained in place, but they were frayed, with all sides now watching their own backs, distrustful of those with whom they had conspired for years. When one contact asked Lowe about all the money that appeared to be missing, he was quick to assign the guilt to Rosma. "She is an avid purchaser of jewelry in the millions. Where is the money from?" he asked. Around 100,000 Malaysians, many of them young urban professionals, swarmed around the center of Kuala Lumpur on August 29, 2015. Wearing yellow t-shirts bearing the slogan Bersih, the Malay word for clean, they marched through the streets, protesting the growing evidence of mass corruption at the heart of their government. The Home Ministry had banned yellow t-shirts after earlier Bersih protests, declaring them a national security threat, but the demonstrators took no heed. One demonstrator carried an effigy of Najib in a cage. Others held up pictures asking how much an average family could purchase of different everyday products, KFC chicken, rice, hot chocolate, with $681 million, the biggest transfers into Najib's accounts. A popular caricature of Rosma, with cartoonishly big hair, replaced her eyeballs with dollar signs. There were Bersih protests in other cities, and by Malaysians living abroad, too. In Kuala Lumpur, many of the protesters stayed out all weekend, sleeping on the streets. Former Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, wearing a safari suit, attended the rally, repeating his call for Najib to step down. Some of the protesters, regular school teachers or office workers, were simply tired of the kleptocracy that Malaysia had become. Others were worried the state was taking an authoritarian turn, closing newspapers and detaining anyone who threatened the ruling party's hold on power. And there were fears the massive debt that 1MDB had incurred would weigh on Malaysia for years to come, leeching funds away from spending on education and social welfare. When you act against the media, it seems like you have something to hide, said Sheila Krishna, a Kuala Lumpur taxi driver. Now a strong man, Najib would endure no opposition. A federal court recently had sent Anwar Ibrahim, the popular opposition leader, back to jail for 5 years for sodomy, prompting criticism from the United States and human rights groups. A couple of weeks after the Bersih protests, pro-government red shirt protesters took to the streets. Some participants admitted to receiving small sums of money to attend. Over the coming months, the red shirts, many of them aggressive-looking ethnic Malays wearing bandanas, disrupted anti-government protests and assaulted activists. Malays, too, can show we can still rise up, Najib said in a fiery speech, praising the red shirt protesters. Glimmers of hope remained. A high court judge ruled the suspension of the Edge's publication license was unlawful, and its journalists once again began holding Najib to account. Some protesters came back into the streets over the ensuing months. But Najib's newfound authoritarianism scared many. A deadly turn would cow even the bravest Malaysians into silence. Part 5. The Captain's Resolve. Chapter 45. Prosecutor in an Oil Drum. Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, September 2015. Just after dawn on September 4th, a workaholic Indian Malaysian named Kevin Morais got into a Proton Perdana sedan for his daily commute to the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission's office in Putrajaya, about an hour's drive from his northern Kuala Lumpur apartment complex. He would never arrive. Since Najib's crackdown several weeks earlier, Morais had become steadily more enraged. The 55-year-old, with a mop of black hair and a haggard tiredness about him, had studied law in London in the 1980s before returning to Malaysia, where he rose to the position of deputy public prosecutor in the Attorney General's office. In Malaysia, corruption cases were plentiful, and Morais often worked weekends, darkening the bags under his heavily lidded eyes. A few months earlier, Morais had, to those who knew him, begun to act strangely. The prosecutor was nervous about a case involving Prime Minister Najib and Rosma, he informed a brother living in the United States. Fearful his phone line was tapped, Morais often talked to his brother in Malayalam, a language of southern India. He sounded frightened and complained about the stress of his job. Morais didn't go into the details of his work, but he was temporarily assigned to the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission. He was working on the money flows from 1MDB to Najib's accounts, and he had helped draw up the draft criminal charges against the Prime Minister. After Najib removed Attorney General Abdul Ghani Patel, Morais felt anxious about his own position. He had even begun worrying about his safety. Only days later, an anonymous leaker emailed a copy of the draft charges the Attorney General's office had been preparing to Claire Rucastle Brown at Sarawak Report. When she published her story, making it clear why Najib had moved so aggressively to fire Abdul Ghani, there was a witch hunt in the Attorney General's office and the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission to find the source of the leak. Police arrested two officials from the commission and a prosecutor from the Attorney General's office. Police filed an arrest warrant for Rucastle Brown, but she was safe in the UK. The detention of the prosecutors caused panic at the Attorney General's office, which was now controlled by a Najib loyalist. Scared into compliance, the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission put out a statement saying the money Najib received was a donation from the Middle East, a fabrication to protect the Prime Minister. Fretful of his central role, Morais took off to England for several days, where he had an apartment in a town near London. He talked to his brother of retiring from government service, and even visited a solicitor to arrange his will. The police soon released the detained lawyers. Morais returned to Malaysia and moved on to other work. as he drove to the office that early September day. The prosecutor tried to focus on his latest case, one involving a Malaysian army pathologist charged with running a medical procurement scam. A few minutes from his complex, the driver of a Mitsubishi Triton truck began to tail the public prosecutor. The truck followed Morais for a while, and then accelerated, ramming his car off the road. Its passengers jumped out, dragged Morais from the car, bundled him into their truck, and sped off. Sometime over the next hour, the assailants murdered Morais, most likely by strangulation, before tying his corpse in a gunny sack, the kind used for storing agricultural products. They put the sack in an oil drum and filled it with liquid concrete, before dumping it in a swampy wasteland near a school. Then the perpetrators torched Morais's car and removed its serial numbers before dumping it in an oil palm plantation. When Morais didn't arrive at work, anxious colleagues and family members alerted police. Just under 2 weeks later, using security camera footage to locate the Mitsubishi Triton, officers made several arrests and were led to the swamp, where they discovered Morais's body. It was a macabre sight, the corpse curled up in a fetal position, encased in concrete like a fossil, still wearing his tie. Police arrested 7 people, including the Malaysian army pathologist, who was charged with abetting the murder. To Morais's family, the official story of his death just didn't add up. The brother was convinced Morais had leaked the draft criminal charges against Prime Minister Najib, and someone had found out about it. He contacted Rucastle Brown, who told him the source, unknown to her, had sent the documents from a Jibby@anonymousspeech.com email address. Jibby was the name of a close family friend of Morais. But Najib's critics also used Jibby as a derisory nickname for the Prime Minister. The sender remained a mystery. The killing had an immediate chilling effect at the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission. Staffers were scared for their lives. But a few brave prosecutors, at enormous personal risk, continued to look for a way to ensure Najib was held to account. The Prime Minister may have seemed secure, but his power only reached so far, and unknown to him, and an ocean away, the case had reached the desks of several special agents in the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Chapter 46. Special Agent Bill McMurray. New York, February 2015. For Special Agent William Bill McMurray, the story about Najib's wealth landed at an opportune time. A veteran FBI agent, McMurray had just been tapped to head a new international corruption squad in New York, and his team was hunting for a high-profile case. With sandy, straight hair and blue eyes, McMurray gave off the air of a middle-aged California surfer, although in reality he was a New Jersey native, who had spent years fighting international crime based out of the FBI's offices in a downtown Manhattan federal building. His biggest triumph to date was unraveling the case of Sister Ping, a Chinatown underworld figure who in 2006 was sent to jail for 35 years for her role in a human trafficking enterprise. After the New York Times story on Joe Lowe's property acquisitions, McMurray's team was tasked with checking out the details. The Wall Street Journal's coverage of Najib's accounts put the case at the front of the queue. The FBI squads, there were also units in Washington and Los Angeles, were an intensification of an effort by the U.S. Justice Department and the FBI to combat kleptocracies. Foreign governments from Russia to Nigeria and Venezuela, dominated by corrupt officials who steal from their treasuries for personal enrichment. It was not pure altruism. The United States for decades had been concerned that corruption would undermine free market capitalism, making it harder for American firms to compete internationally. And then there were fears that kleptocracy, the word is from the Greek and means rule by thieves, would lead to a less stable world order, in which failed states like Afghanistan and Syria harbor terrorists. Corruption leads to lack of confidence in government. Lack of confidence in government leads to failed states, and failed states lead to terror and national security issues, was how Special Agent Jeffrey Sillett, chief of the FBI's public corruption section, put it when announcing the international corruption squads. Corrupt foreign leaders and officials had an Achilles heel. They relied on the U.S. financial system to transfer cash and had a penchant for acquiring real estate in New York, Los Angeles, and Miami. The Justice Department set up the Kleptocracy Asset Recovery Initiative in 2010 to coordinate the work of FBI investigators and prosecutors to seize the U.S. and global assets of corrupt foreign officials. If those kleptocrats were no longer in power, Washington would transfer the proceeds back to the countries. In 2014, the Justice Department oversaw the seizure of more than $480 million in corruption proceeds hidden in bank accounts around the world by former Nigerian dictator Sani Abacha. The 1MDB scheme, McMurray's team must have soon realized, was of a whole different magnitude. For one thing, Lowe just seemed so brash. His money laundering techniques, although sophisticated, had been carried out through major banks, and there was a solid money trail. This was easier to deal with than Pakistani money launderers, who often would go into hiding for years and make their funds disappear through the informal Hawala money transfer network. Then there was the scale. The 1MDB affair was shaping up as the single largest financial scam of all time. On the ground, Robert Heukling, a 34-year-old FBI special agent who worked for McMurray, was attempting to get his head around this mind-numbingly complex case. Slender, with blue eyes and an athletic build, Heukling studied journalism at Northwestern University before joining the U.S. Marines, and he had worked at the FBI for 5 years. McMurray made him lead on the case, by far the most weighty of his short career. Justin McNair, an agent who had forensic accounting experience, was another senior member of the group. Alongside a team of federal prosecutors, and with access to data from the U.S. financial system, as well as cooperation with law enforcement agencies in Switzerland and Singapore, the agents were making progress. But there was a problem. Money laundering cases are by nature multi-jurisdictional, making them time-consuming to investigate. On sprawling international cases, prosecutors rely on what are known as mutual legal assistance treaties, which allow for the sharing of information, documents, sworn statements, and the like, between law enforcement agencies. The United States had signed such a pact with Malaysia in 2006, and Switzerland had a similar agreement. Najib's administration, however, was declining to cooperate. At first, Najib privately expressed confidence that Western nations would not pursue investigations into 1MDB, wagering Malaysia's status as a U.S. ally would buffer it from intrusions into what he considered a domestic matter. It soon became clear the foreign investigations were not going to melt away. At a meeting of public prosecutors in Zurich, Attorney General Mohammed Apandi Ali, the loyalist Najib had installed in the job, urged his Swiss counterpart, Michael Lauber, to abandon his investigation. Lauber refused. The Najib administration also tried diplomatic channels to get the FBI to drop its probe, without luck. But the Prime Minister instructed his Attorney General not to cooperate with overseas probes, and that left foreign investigators without access to crucial Malaysian banking documents. Investigators in Abu Dhabi, where the scandal threatened to highlight the shabby business practices of Sheikh Mansour, were similarly keen not to air their dirty laundry in public. It was one thing to quietly remove Al-Kubaisi from his position, but quite another to launch a full-blown probe that could embarrass a senior royal figure. The broad contours of the scheme had appeared in the pages of Sarawak Report and the Wall Street Journal, but only the first heist, involving the $1.5 billion taken from 1MDB starting in 2009, was clearly drawn. The journal began to focus on exactly how Prime Minister Najib had gotten paid in 2013, and the money trail led to Abu Dhabi. Joe Lowe was perturbed by questions the Prime Minister had received from the journal. Focusing on the money flows, we had figured out discrepancies between 1MDB's financial reports and those of IPIC. The Abu Dhabi Fund had guaranteed $3.5 billion in 1MDB bonds sold by Goldman Sachs in 2012, and in return, the Malaysian Fund's financial statements showed it had transferred $1.4 billion in collateral to IPIC. The collateral was accounted for in 1MDB's accounts as a non-current deposit, meaning it would be repaid by IPIC in the future, but was not at that moment available in cash. This struck us as strange. Why issue bonds and then pay almost half of the proceeds in collateral to the guarantor of the bonds? But what we discovered next deepened the mystery. IPIC's financial reports made no mention of receiving the money. Around this time, we developed a crucial deep throat informant. Referred to internally at the journal as Malaysian Source, or MS, the person had intimate knowledge of the workings of every aspect of what had transpired, yet because of personal involvement, was also motivated to mislead us. The person passed wire transfer documents to the journal that appeared to show the $1.4 billion indeed flowed from 1MDB to Abar, the IPIC subsidiary. MS was hoping we would accept this at face value and move on. But the documents, in fact, showed the money had been sent to Abar Investments Limited, the lookalike British Virgin Islands-based shell company, controlled by Al-Kubaisi and Al-Husseini. We searched offshore company databases and took the information to government sources in Abu Dhabi, who confirmed that IPIC and Abar did not formally control this company. Although Abu Dhabi authorities didn't want to embarrass Sheikh Mansour, it was evident to IPIC's new management that Al-Kubaisi could not bear the blame alone. The Persian Gulf suspected Joe Lowe and began investigating the matter. Malaysian sources' efforts to mislead us had backfired, handing the journal a scoop about the existence of this lookalike shell company, one of Joe Lowe's trademark methods for siphoning cash. We then wrote to Najib asking why IPIC had not received money that 1MDB claimed to have sent, citing Abu Dhabi investigators. The Petro-Saudi fraud already had been laid bare, and now Lowe feared the uncovering of another major part of his scheme, the removal of cash from the 2012 power plant bonds. He moved fast to keep a lid on the truth. Turning to Ambassador Oteiba and Al-Mubarak of Mubadala, Lowe worked to stop the journal's story in its tracks. He was particularly worried by our discovery that Abu Dhabi investigators had found no trace of the money. He was losing control of events, worried by our ability to communicate with Abu Dhabi officials. In an email, Lowe, using a pseudonym, sent across to Oteiba and Al-Mubarak the questions we had asked Prime Minister Najib, attached to which he made his own request. Malaysian side is extremely concerned and wants to ensure strategy to be consistent and coordinated, Lowe wrote. Najib was keen, he went on, to make sure Abu Dhabi did not formally investigate the missing cash. Instead, the Emirates should stick to the agreed story. Al-Kubaisi was to blame, and a deal was in place for Abu Dhabi to cover the $3.5 billion in bonds, with Malaysia later repaying the Persian Gulf state with cash or other assets. Note, there are enough reviews on 1MDB being done by various regulators. There is a concern that an additional review done by an Abu Dhabi investigative team will open another unnecessary attack avenue for detractors, Lowe wrote. Neither the Prime Minister nor the 1MDB fund, now headed by Arul Khanda, a slick financier in his early 40s who previously had worked at an Abu Dhabi bank and knew Joe Lowe, responded to the journal's queries. But after the newspaper reported about the missing Abu Dhabi money, the Malaysian fund reacted aggressively. a former high school debate champion, Arul Khanda took on the journal's stories with sharp-worded tirades that claimed the newspaper was part of a wide political conspiracy